From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Egypt reserves the right of retaliation, and with the methods and timing it sees fit for retribution from those murderers and criminals who are without the slightest humanity.
4 years after the U.S.-led bombing campaign toppled Muammar Gaddafi's government, Libya is in a state of crisis. On Monday, Egypt bombed Islamic State targets in Libya after the group released a video showing the beheading of 21 Coptic Christians. Meanwhile, two different governments run Libya, each with their own parliaments and armies. Will foreign governments intervene in Libya again? We'll speak with Professor Vijay Prashad and Democracy Now!'s Sharif Abdelkaddous in Cairo. Plus, we'll hear the latest on the Al Jazeera journalists released on bail as they await yet another trial in Egypt. Then, as Greece rejects an extension of its European bailout, an anti-austerity party called Podemos is on the rise in Spain. We'll speak to the party's leader, Pablo Iglesias. Could he become Spain's next prime minister?
My country have three big problems, inequality, unemployment, and debt. And the Socialist Party and the Popular Party in my country understood that the best way to improve the situation was austerity. After 5 years, or even more, even 6 years, the situation is worse than before.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Egypt has opened a new front in the war against the Islamic State. On Monday, Egyptian warplanes bombed northeastern Libya after Cairo vowed to avenge the killing of 21 Coptic Christians, shown in an ISIS video. Egypt says it hit ISIS sites, quote, precisely, but at least seven civilians, including three children, were reportedly killed in the coastal city of Derna. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, meanwhile, called for a UN resolution to launch a global coalition to intervene in Libya.
What is going on in Libya could change this country into a breeding ground that will threaten the whole region, and not only Egypt. Egypt, the Mediterranean basin, and Europe have to deal with this problem because the mission was unaccomplished, was unfinished by our European friends. We abandoned the Libyan people as prisoners to extremist militias.
The U.S.-led coalition, meanwhile, launched 15 airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq and Syria on Sunday and Monday. In Pakistan, at least seven people have been killed in the suicide bombing of a police headquarters in the eastern city of Lahore. A Taliban splinter group claimed responsibility, calling the attack revenge for Pakistan's execution of its colleagues. In breaking news from eastern Ukraine, Russian-backed separatists claim to have seized control of the key city of Dabltsev. Fierce fighting has raged in the area despite a ceasefire agreement. Talks between Greece and its European creditors have collapsed amidst disagreement over the future of German-backed austerity. The Greek Syriza Party was elected on a promise to roll back the devastating austerity measures in Greece's international bailout. At talks in Brussels, Greek negotiators rejected a deal to extend the terms of the current bailout. Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis said he had tried to negotiate.
We were offering to refrain from effectively implementing our own program, the program that we were elected to implement, for a period of 6 months. And all we were getting back was a nebulous promise of some flexibility that was never specified. Under those circumstances, ladies and gentlemen, it proved impossible for the Greek government, despite our infinite goodwill, to sign the offered communique. And so the discussions continue.
The breakdown has raised fears Greece may be on the verge of leaving the eurozone. The talks in Brussels came after some 20,000 people rallied in Athens to support Syriza's stance against austerity. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the leader of the anti-austerity party in Spain, Pablo Iglesias. A CSX train carrying over 100 cars of crude oil has derailed in West Virginia, sending a massive fireball into the sky and forcing 1,000 people to evacuate. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin has declared a state of emergency. At least 14 tankers and a house caught on fire, and at least one car went into the Kanawha River, where it was leaking oil. The train was transporting oil from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, where a fracking boom has increased oil by rail shipments more than 4,000% in recent years. The incident came after another oil train derailed in Ontario, Canada, Saturday night, sparking a fire that was still burning on Monday. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez is due in California today for talks aimed at ending a contract dispute between shipping companies and union dock workers. For days, the shipping firms have partially shut down activity at 29 West Coast ports, handling nearly half of all U.S. maritime trade after accusing workers of waging a slowdown. But union officials deny the slowdown and blame backups on the companies. The dispute has left dozens of container ships idling off the coast. A federal judge in Texas has blocked President Obama's executive actions on immigration. In November, Obama outlined programs aimed at providing relief from deportation to as many as 5 million people. But Texas and 25 other states sued to oppose the measures. 2 days before the first of the programs was due to start taking applications, Judge Andrew Hanen blocked them. A new probe finds the National Security Agency has embedded spying devices deep inside hard drives in computers around the world. The Russian firm Kaspersky Lab says it uncovered the spyware in personal computers across 30 countries, from Iran, Russia, Pakistan and Libya, to China, Belgium, Ecuador and the United States. The targets include government institutions, oil and gas firms, Islamic activists and scholars, and the media. Hundreds of people gathered at the Danish embassy in Paris to express solidarity with Denmark over the weekend attacks on a free speech event and a synagogue. The Danish ambassador to France, Anna Dorte Riggelsen, said the feelings are similar to those that followed last month's attacks on Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris.
It's really moving because what I feel is that everyone feels Danish, like we all felt French. Charlie, cop, Jew. And this solidarity that's almost physical and corporeal is very, very important for my country, for my people, because today we are in mourning.
Danish authorities have arrested two people accused of assisting the Copenhagen gunman, Omar Abdelhamid El-Hussein, who was shot dead by police. In the U.S., a North Carolina grand jury has indicted Craig Hicks on 3 counts of murder for killing 3 Muslim students in Chapel Hill. Police have claimed the shooting stemmed from a parking dispute, but the victim's family has said it was clearly a hate crime. In a statement, Hada Wad, head of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, said, quote, "This case is quickly becoming a touchstone for the American Muslim community's sense of security and inclusion." Authorities in Houston, Texas, have arrested a homeless man for setting a fire at an Islamic center last week. Officials say Darrell Ferguson approached officers and admitted to starting the fire. He told reporters it was an accident. In Detroit, a federal judge has rejected a bid for a new trial from a Palestinian activist convicted of immigration fraud. Rasmia Oda was found guilty of concealing her conviction on bombing charges by an Israeli military court more than 40 years ago. She says her confession to the bombings was obtained through torture and sexual assault in Israeli custody. Supporters say she was targeted by U.S. authorities because of her prominent support for Palestinian liberation. She faces up to 10 years in prison and deportation at her sentencing next month. To hear about her story, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. The decision comes just days after the Israeli Supreme Court rejected an appeal from the family of Rachel Corrie, the U.S. activist crushed to death by an Israeli army bulldozer in Gaza nearly 12 years ago, as she tried to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. Rachel Corrie's parents had sued the Israeli Ministry of Defense for a symbolic $1 in damages. But a lower court cleared the military of responsibility, saying Rachel Corrie's death had taken place in a war zone. Last week, the Supreme Court upheld that decision. The Corrie family said in a statement, quote, "We'd hope for a different outcome, though we have come to see through this experience how deeply all of Israel's institutions are implicated in the impunity enjoyed by the Israeli military," they said. Amnesty International has renewed its call for Louisiana to release one of the longest-serving U.S. prisoners in solitary confinement. Former Black Panther Albert Woodfox's conviction has been overturned three times, and in November, an appeals court upheld the latest court order for his release. But last week, a Louisiana grand jury reindicted Woodfox for the 1972 murder of a prison guard. He and the late Herman Wallace, another member of the so-called Angola Three, said they were framed for their political activism. In a statement, Amnesty International called for Louisiana Attorney General Buddy Caldwell to, quote, stop pursuing a campaign of vengeance by trying to reindict a man who's already spent more than four decades in cruel confinement after a legal process tainted with flaws, unquote. Albert Woodfox turned 68 this Thursday. And Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber is preparing for his final day in office Wednesday, after announcing he would step down amidst a public corruption probe. Since Oregon does not have a lieutenant governor, Secretary of State Kate Brown will take his place, becoming the first openly bisexual governor in U.S. history. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Aaron Maté. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Egypt has opened a new front in the war against ISIS. On Monday, Egyptian warplanes bombed northeastern Libya after Cairo vowed to avenge the killing of 21 Coptic Christians. Egypt claims it hit ISIS targets, quote, precisely, but at least seven civilians, including three children, were reportedly killed in the coastal city of Derna. The bombings come after the Islamic State released a video showing the beheading of the 21 kidnapped Egyptians. The victims are led onto a beach dressed in orange jumpsuits, like Guantanamo Bay prisoners. They are then beheaded one by one. The lead executioner points his knife at the camera and delivers a message to what he calls the Crusaders.
O people, recently you've seen us on the hills of Hashem and on Dabok's plain, chopping off the heads that have been carrying across the Lotion for a long time, filled with spite against Islam and Muslims. And today we're on the south of Rome, on the land of Islam, Libya, sending another message. O Crusaders, safety for you will be only wishes, especially when you're fighting us all together.
The victims were all migrant workers kidnapped late last year. There are now reports more Egyptians have been kidnapped inside Libya in recent days. The video is the first showing an Islamic State beheading outside of its strongholds in Syria and Iraq. ISIS is one of several militant groups that have emerged inside Libya since the U.S.-backed overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Today marks 4 years since the official start of the Libyan revolution, which ended in Gaddafi's ouster and death.
Now the country faces what the United Nations calls the worst political crisis and escalation of violence since that time. Two different governments run Libya, each with their own parliaments and armies. The internationally recognized government operates from the eastern cities of Tobruk and Baida after a rival group called Libya Dawn seized the capital Tripoli in August. A number of militant groups, including the Islamic State affiliate, are scattered in between. Egypt's bombing marks the first time ISIS has been targeted with strikes outside Iraq and Syria. And although it emerged in the upheaval following the 2011 intervention, there's talk now of a new foreign operation beyond the Egyptian strikes. On Monday, Italy said it would weigh attacks on the Islamic State in Libya if UN-backed talks failed to reconcile Libya's rival factions. Italian Interior Minister Angelino Alfano called for direct NATO intervention, saying, quote, ISIS is at the door. There is no time to waste. The current war authorization measure before the U.S. Congress also increases the prospect of direct U.S. intervention. President Obama's asked lawmakers to grant him expansive authority to target the Islamic State anywhere in the world beyond the current campaign in Syria and Iraq. With Washington's ally, Egypt, starting a new front, that opens the question of whether Libya is next on the U.S. target list. For more, we're joined by two guests. From Cairo, we're joined by Sharif Abdelkaddous, Democracy Now!'s correspondent and a fellow at the Nation Institute. He's just returned from a reporting trip in Libya. And joining us is Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College, columnist for the Indian magazine Frontline. He's the author of several books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and most recently, The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. He's joining us from Connecticut Public Television, the PBS station in Hartford. Professor Vijay Prashad, let's begin with you. The significance of the Egyptian strike on Libya, ISIS's beheading of the Christian—of the Coptic Christians from Egypt?
Amy, this is not the first Egyptian airstrike in Libya. It's reported, although Egypt denies it, that in August of last year, Egyptian fighter planes alongside fighter planes from the UAE struck targets near Tripoli, the capital of Libya, at that time going after the escalation by Libyan Dawn to capture the city and the parliament. Libyan Dawn is dominated, it's a coalition, but dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, the group that President Sisi has seen as his main enemy inside Egypt. So when Egypt began its second round of airstrikes on Monday, the parliament in Tripoli, again dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, immediately condemned the airstrike as a violation of Libyan sovereignty. The problem with the Egyptian airstrikes has been that in a very short time, it has immediately opened up the polarization inside Libya, precisely the opposite political direction which Libya requires at this time, according to the United Nations.
Well, Vijay, can you talk about how we've come to this point where 4 years after the Libyan revolution began, now the Islamic State is claiming territory there and carrying out a brutal attack such as this one?
Well, it's a great, consternation and shame, I think, to the so-called international community that this NATO intervention of 2011 came on the heels of geopolitical wrangling between the Gulf Arab states and the Europeans. This intervention came in. It destroyed much of Libyan infrastructure at a crucial point when Mr. Gaddafi was taken prisoner. If he had been allowed to surrender, for instance, there might have been a process opened up to bring different factions to a political table. Instead, of course, he was brutally killed, and the possibility of reconciliation at that point was squandered. Secondly, there was no attempt by any party to bring the various revolutionaries, the Thuar, into any kind of umbrella organization. They were allowed to have a fissiparous existence, returning to their various cities, creating, deepening their separation, deepening the kind of antipathy between amongst them. And in this, strange position, the NATO-backed government took power in Tripoli, where many opportunities by this government were also squandered. You know, there were oil workers' strikes. There was the question of the armed militias. At no point did the government in Tripoli seem engaged by these pressing issues. Instead, one of the first acts of this government was to create a central bank. It was very interested in making deals for oil, but at really no point did they attempt a genuine political process of reconciliation inside the country. That has torn apart Libya. It alienated the East. And for the first time in Libya, a sophisticated al-Qaeda-type group was allowed to flourish, and that was Ansar al-Sharia, which grew out in Benghazi. You know, the previous Islamist group, the Libyan International Islamist Fighting Group, had by 2011 put itself at the service of the government, but that gesture was as well rebuffed. So, I mean, I think a combination of Gulf Arab animosity, you know, between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the, maybe really disregard by the West, and internal problems where the government in Tripoli that rode into power on the backs of NATO really alienated the population from any possibility of a future.
I want to bring Sharif El-Quddus into this conversation in Egypt's capital, Cairo. Sharif, can you talk about the response right now in Egypt to Egypt's bombing of Libya, where you just were, and who the people were who were killed in Egypt, the Coptic Christians killed by ISIS there?
Right. Well, the airing of the video really struck a chord amongst many Egyptians, especially the Coptic Christian community. The nature of the message, there was no political demands made. It was an entirely sectarian message that that was delivered. The strikes are significant. Vijay is right that there have been covert strikes before, especially in coordination with the United Arab Emirates on Libya by Egypt. But they're significant insofar as they're the first publicly acknowledged foreign military military intervention by Egypt, arguably since the Gulf War, more than or nearly a quarter of a century ago. They claim the Libyan army claims that they hit 95% of their targets and they killed over 50 militants. But you know that's rarely the case. That kind of accuracy in aerial bombing, and already Human Rights Watch has said 6 civilians were killed, including a mother and 2 children. But politically, certainly domestically, the strikes were a success. Before the airing of this video, the families of the hostages held protests against the government, accusing the government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of not doing enough to release the hostages. But since the airstrikes, Sisi has received widespread support. He's seen as having acted swiftly and decisively. The state and private media, which is really a vocal chorus for Sisi, is whipping up a lot of nationalist sentiment. The army has been deployed to the streets to, quote-unquote, protect citizens. And really, the war on terror is Sisi's source of legitimacy. It's his raison d'etre. So this is all playing into that vein. In terms of the 21 Coptic Christian men, the majority of them all came from one small village in central Egypt called Al-Ur. And they were like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Egyptians do, migrant workers who left Egypt to search for better wages in Libya. They can earn up to 7 times the paltry sums they can earn here in Egypt, in Libya's oil-rich economy. They ended up in Sirte, which is a coastal city in central Libya that was the birthplace of Gaddafi, but has since become a stronghold for militants, especially groups like Ansar al-Sharia, which was accused of killing U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens in 2012, but has since been infiltrated by even more extreme militants. And survivors who evaded capture by the militants really describe a harrowing ordeal where these militants were coming house by house, calling out these migrant workers by name, leaving the Muslims and taking the Coptic Christian men. And so it really was, I think, sent shockwaves through much of Egypt to see this video aired.
And the response of Egyptian society in terms of religions, why Coptic Christians, do you think, were targeted, and the place of Coptic Christians in greater Egyptian society?
Well, this is not the first time Coptic Christians have been targeted in Libya. A doctor and his wife and daughter were killed in December. There have been other incidents as well. We can only look to what the statement by the Islamic State group was, and it was calling for revenge for the Coptic Christian crusade and this very overtly sectarian nature of the attacks. Egypt has a Coptic Christian minority, which is about 10% of the population, and they suffer from discrimination in various types of laws of how they can build churches and other ways of discrimination as well, in terms of marriage laws and so forth. So, you know, this really struck a chord within the community. But I think overall, there is now in Egyptian society this hyped-up sentiment for war, and there's a lot of support, it seems, for these airstrikes.
And Sharif, you were just in Libya, this bombing coming just as the UN is trying to broker some kind of deal between the two rival factions that claim two different governments with two different armies and parliaments. What can you tell us about the internal conflict inside Libya and how these Egyptian strikes might affect them?
Well, you know, there's a power struggle that's engulfing the country, as Vijay outlined. And Libya's really, to go there, it's really, it's hardly a country anymore. It's really a torn stretch of land. And Libyans have to negotiate a minefield of regional, political, and tribal conflicts just in order to survive. You have these two rival coalitions, which are opposed to each other, each with their own array of militias, each with their own prime minister and government, and each claiming legitimacy. You have in the east, in Baida and Tobruk, the internationally recognized government that is allied with Khalifa Haftar, a former general who has waged a battle against Islamist militias in Benghazi. And they were forced out of the capital in a weeks-long battle over the summer. And in the west, in Tripoli, where the oil ministry is, where the National Oil Corporation is, you have the self-declared government, which, very broadly speaking, is backed by an array of militias which are Islamist-aligned, but also has a tactical alliance with very extreme militias over whom they have no control. And so this conflict has been raging, has caused massive displacement, has created a void in which groups like the Islamic State group can flourish, really. And there was one driver that we had at one point, and he gave a telling quote saying, in the east, they assume I'm Fajr, which is Libya Dawn. In the west, they assume I'm Karama, which is Hifters. And in Derna, they want to behead me, referring to the Islamic State group. And so this is the kind of political situation that Libyans find themselves in. And the politicians seem to be operating in a different realm from ordinary Libyans, a realm that has everything to do with power and very little to do with governing.
I want to turn to Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former head of NATO. Speaking to Britain's Channel 4 Monday, he said foreign boots will be needed on the ground in Libya.
The brief answer is we will need boots on the ground. It's clear that you can't do the job through air campaigns alone. You need boots on the ground. The only question is which boots. And in that respect, I do believe that countries in the region should play a major role in deploying such forces. But they can't do that, and they won't do that unless the West supports.
That's Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former head of NATO. Which boots on the ground, Professor Vijay Prashad? What about what he's saying? Not only should there be, but which ones?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Mr. Rasmussen has categorically, over the last 4 years, said that NATO should not get involved in Syria because it's too complicated and the issue is fraught with all kinds of consequences. In Libya, on the other hand, is, you know, there's a attitude towards it, which is that it's a playground. You know, you can encourage intervention. You can let people come in. I mean, I think it's a very dangerous attitude for the simple reason that unless the political question is somewhat settled, talking about sending boots on the ground, whether Egyptian or Algerian, is, I think, a mistake. And what I'm trying to say is that there is an Arab Cold War that's broken out in northern Africa, where, you know, on the one side you have Saudi Arabia, you know, with Egypt perhaps, with the UAE. On the other side, you have Qatar and you have Turkey. You have these countries that are helping fuel internal disagreements. And until there's an understanding that these external actors need to stop providing succor to internal contradictions, and until the UN is able to bring these internal parties to sit down and construct some kind of political dialogue which is real, to talk about sending in boots on the ground is only going to exacerbate matters. If Egypt enters with its considerable military into Libya, this is going to create a great deal of problems with Qatar, and God knows what they would do. Meanwhile, of course, the Islamic State is looking forward to greater Egyptian intervention, because one of the reasons that they are going after the Copts is not only because their preferred enemy, the Shia, are non-existent in Libya, but also they've been seeking a way to create greater fractures in Egypt itself, to insinuate themselves in Egypt. So the idea of having boots on the ground without putting great pressure on the major Arab countries in the region to sort of cool it on their own internal fights that are greatly affecting Libyan politics. Until that happens, I fear that it's naive to talk about airstrikes, and it's incredibly naive and duplicitous to talk about boots on the ground.
Well, Vijay, on the issue of naivete, looking back, Libya was hailed as a model for humanitarian intervention after Gaddafi was overthrown and killed. Now, though, I imagine as the country unravels and descends into this resting ground for Islamist militant groups like ISIS, defenders of the NATO intervention will point back to Benghazi. At the time, there appeared to be, at least in my opinion back then, a credible threat that Gaddafi was going to carry out a massacre in Benghazi. And the argument was that something had to be done. Now, putting aside what NATO's actual motives were, the threat of a massacre did seem credible. But I'm wondering, looking back now, what we know in hindsight, do you think that that particular pretext of preventing atrocities in Benghazi stands up to scrutiny?
Well, you know, it depends what you're going to look at. If you're going to look at the evidence that Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International produced after the worst part of the NATO bombing ended, it's not clear that the casualty rates that had been claimed, particularly by the Saudi media, which was Al Arabiya, it's not clear that those casualty rates were accurate. In fact, they were greatly exaggerated, so that the claim by Al Arabiya that there were already massacres in Misrata, that there was a massacre in Ras Lanuf, etc., turns out in the end not to have been true. Now, it's not to say that the Gaddafi government wasn't prepared to conduct very brutal violence in the east and in cities in the center. But you have to recognize, and this is what I think the international media at the time wasn't willing to inhale, you have to recognize that in the east, Gaddafi's military largely defected to the rebellion, so that the battalion and the air command in Benghazi was on the side of the rebellion. There had already been aerial strikes by rebel aircraft against Gaddafi boats that were in the Mediterranean. So what I'm saying is that there was a very complicated situation at the time. Mainly Saudi media and then pushed by various international media, including CNN, began to drum up this idea that there was a massacre. I remember in the UN Security Council, ambassadors talking about getting their information from the international media. That struck me as really very, very disturbing, particularly given the fact that credible human rights organizations, after the fact, showed that the numbers had been greatly exaggerated by news media, particularly by Al Arabiya.
Sherif Abdelkaddous, before we end this segment, could you comment on the ground, just having been in Libya, about the humanitarian crisis there?
Right. Libya, ordinary Libyans are really suffering. There is massive displacement. The UN estimates about 400,000 have been displaced. Many of them are living in schools. Many have left the country altogether. Many civil society activists, journalists, writers have left under threats. Those Libyans who do want to leave because they can find no more life in Libya find that the world has rejected them. Many complain that they can't get visas because they're Libyan. And most of the displaced that we saw were from Benghazi, Libya's second largest city, which is the birthplace of the revolution and is now really the epicenter of the disaster. People describe completely bombed out neighborhoods. They said it looks like Aleppo. There's neighborhood youth who are armed, manning checkpoints all over the city. And, you know, just the simple truth of where you're from can determine your fate. And just overall dysfunction has really become a way of life in Libya. Libyans are forced to bear the burden of the conflict as it tears away the last vestiges of normalcy. Traveling across the country is arduous. Delays at airports can literally take days. If you want to go by car, then you're going to risk checkpoints and kidnapping and different militias, which you have to negotiate. In the east, particularly, there's very bad electricity shortages. There's fuel shortages. We were in Baida, which is the seat of the internationally recognized government. They are experiencing a huge influx of refugees there, of displaced. This has caused rents to go up, food prices to go up. There's food shortages. The crisis is most acutely felt in the hospital, where, for example, we went to the kidney treatment center, which is receiving now three times more patients. And so for dialysis, they have to ration treatment. And a technician told us how this is reducing the lifespan of patients. He told it to us in English because he was saying it as a patient was getting dialysis. He spoke of how his newborn niece, died because they couldn't find a very simple tube for a blood transfusion that she needed, and she died before they could even name her. And in Tripoli, you see masked gunmen at checkpoints at night for the first time. They've never been masked before. The streets are deserted. You speak to government officials. The defense minister, Khalifa Ghuel, was telling us how safe Tripoli was. The very next day, armed militants stormed the biggest hotel in Tripoli, the Carinthia Hotel, and killed 9 people, including a number of foreigners. So this is really, it's really quite a disaster for ordinary Libyans. And there needs to be some kind of political solution on the ground because, you know, jihadists thrive on more war. And this whole talk of more conflict, I don't think will solve much in the long term.
Sharif, we want to ask you to stay with us in our next segment to briefly update us on the Al Jazeera journalists who are now going on trial. Who must remain in Egypt, but they are out on bail. Sharif Abdelkaddous Demarchi now is correspondent in Cairo and a fellow at the Nation Institute, recently returned from a reporting trip inside Libya. And thank you so much to Professor Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College, columnist for the Indian magazine Frontline, author of a number of books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and most recently, The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. In our next segment, we'll be speaking with the head of Podemos in Spain, Pablo Iglesias. Some are wondering if he will be the next prime minister of Spain. But first, we remain in Egypt. Aaron?
As we continue in Egypt, where Al Jazeera journalists Mohamed Fakhmi and Bahar Mohamed are free on bail after over a year in prison. The pair and a third colleague, Peter Greste, were arrested as part of a crackdown on Al Jazeera following the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. They were sentenced last June to between 7 and 10 years in prison, a ruling condemned around the world.
Peter Greste was released earlier this month and deported home to Australia. Then last week, after over 400 days behind bars, Mohamed Fahmy and Bahar Mohamed were freed on bail. On Monday, Bahar Mohamed celebrated his newfound freedom. Despite their release, the case has not been dismissed. A new hearing is scheduled for next week. Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous has covered the story from the beginning. You can see his report on last week's court proceedings ordering the pair's release at our website, democracynow.org. And he's been covering the case for the Toronto Star, Canada's largest daily newspaper. He interviewed Mohamed Fahmy for a front-page article on Sunday. Very briefly, Sharif, if you can tell us the latest and tell us about Mohamed Fahmy, his feelings now about Egypt, about Canada.
Well, Amy, it was a rare moment of joy in an Egyptian courtroom when the judge ordered bail. They've been in prison for 411 days, and finally they've been released. But I think we have to realize that they still have this ongoing trial. They still face the same charges, and there's still the danger. Mohamed Fahmy has been very critical of the Canadian government. The government of Stephen Harper has close ties to the Sisi regime, and they have not—Harper has not personally intervened. He's calling on Harper to call Sisi. He's looking to be deported to Canada and benefit from a decree that Sisi passed in November, which allowed Peter Greste to be reported. Fahmy is also very upset that he was essentially, he says, tricked into giving up his Egyptian citizenship in the hopes of benefiting from that decree. He was pressured by senior Egyptian officials, and now he had to pay a $33,000 bail to get out when the other prisoners didn't, and he lost his Egyptian nationality. And I just want to take a chance also to highlight the fact that while these journalists have received a lot of attention, there are other other journalists who have practically no attention who are imprisoned in Egypt, one of whom is Mahmoud Abu Zayd. His name is he's known as Shawkan. He's a photojournalist. He's been in prison for 550 days in a 3-by-4-meter cell with 12 other prisoners. He describes his ordeal as an endless nightmare. So while we're happy that these two journalists are finally reunited with their families, there's still other journalists in prison and tens of thousands of political prisoners in Egypt as well.
Sharif, I want to thank you for being with us. Sharif Abdelkaddous, Democracy Now!'s correspondent in Cairo, fellow at the Nation Institute, has just returned from a reporting trip in Libya. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from break, we speak to the leader of a new party in Spain that has garnered massive support. It's called Podemos. We can. Stay with us.
La vie, si c'est un parlava, de bon matí el portal, mentre el sol esperaven i els carros veien passar. Siset, que no veus l'estaca on estem tots lligats, si no podem desfensar, mai no podrem caminar.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
We turn now to Europe. On Monday, talks between Greece and Eurozone finance ministers over Athens' debt broke down when the newly elected leftist Syriza government rejected a deal to extend the terms of the current bailout. Meanwhile, a new anti-austerity party is also gaining popularity in Spain, Europe's fifth-largest economy. On January 31st, as many as 150,000 people rallied in Madrid to show support for the Podemos party. That translates into "We Can." Podemos only became an official party last March, but a recent poll found 28% of the population supports it, enough to possibly win Spain's next general election.
Last May, Podemos surprised many when it received 1.2 million votes and 5 seats in the European Parliament elections. The party grew out of the Indignados movement that began occupying squares in Spain 4 years ago. The Indignados rallied against austerity cuts, rising unemployment, and Spain's political establishment. On Monday, I sat down with Pablo Iglesias, the secretary general of Podemos. He is a 36-year-old political science professor, longtime activist who was elected to the European Parliament last year. If Podemos wins Spain's national elections later this year, he could become Spain's next prime minister. He is in New York. I began by asking him to talk about Podemos.
Probably we are the answer to austerity policies in our country. I never thought it was possible a political phenomenon as us in our country, and probably we are the result of the disaster of these policies of austerity in Spain, and probably we are the expression of the hope now. People in my country is starting to understand that in democracy, when something is going wrong, you can do the things well. And probably we are a new opportunity of change in Spain, and we are very happy to be an instrument of the people for the political change.
What exactly does austerity mean?
Austerity means that people is expulsed of their homes. Austerity means that the social services don't work anymore. Austerity means that public schools have not the elements, the means to develop their activity. Austerity means that the countries have not sovereignty anymore, and we became a colony of the financial powers and a colony of Germany. Austerity probably means the end of democracy. I think if we don't have democratic control of economy, we don't have democracy. It's impossible to separate economy and democracy, in my opinion.
Can you explain what the Indignados movement is, what it means?
The Indignados movement is probably the best expression of an organic crisis in the political regime in Spain. In Gramscian terms, that means this demonstration in Puerta del Sol and in other places in Spain, means the end of the consensus with this political regime in Spain. Even if the electoral expression of that of that new situation was not immediately. I think that it was the basis, it was the key element that allowed us finally to get this support we are getting now.
So you've won in the European Parliament. What is your strategy going forward?
The first thing is to make visible the problems that European citizens have. And we use all the time the European Parliament in order to give visibility to social groups and to give visibility to problems in order to open a discussion in the society. And in fact, the media attention to the European Parliament since we are there is great, is growing, and we are happy with that.
Podemos has organized citizens' assemblies.
Yes. We have circles. Circles are the local aggregation of people of Podemos, and we have more than 1,200 in Spain and overseas. In the United States, there is a circle, a Podemos circle, I will meet them today, and tonight we have a meeting with them and a conference, and I'm
And
very
what
happy.
Do these circles do?
The circles are activists, and they organize campaigns. They have meetings with civil society in their cities and in their districts. They are the basis. They are the most important instrument of Podemos in order to have relationship with society.
Pablo Iglesias, can you explain the political landscape in Spain? The PP, the socialists, your own party, Podemos, even the other parties, Izquierda Unida, and why your party rose up and pulled away support from these other parties?
Probably we have been able to change the chess party, the chess game, because we don't accept this all distinction between left and right. Obviously, I'm a leftist, but I think that this game that separate the political field between center-left and center-right sometimes is something very useful to make the banks win. And we say, we have a program. We have a program defending democracy. We want social services, we want public education, we want sovereignty, and we are sure that there is a majority of the society that is supporting us. So it's not a problem for us the past of the people. If you in the past vote for the right, no problem for us. If you support our ideas, if you support the possibility of a political change in Spain, if you support democracy, you can be with us. In fact, the two message of the 15M movement in our country.
And that was May 15th?
Yeah, exactly, May 15th. It was, we want democracy and we don't feel represented by this elite of all politicians. So we think that there is a big difference between the old situation and the new situation. And people in Spain is starting to understand that the old political elites are not able to improve the situation and to resolve the economic and political problems in my country.
Pablo, how did you move from being a movement to a party? How was that decision made?
For necessity, because we understood very well that if you need to change the things, you need political power. And we were activists and we used to work in social fields, in the civil society. But we know that it's very important to occupy the institutional powers in order to change things. It's quite important to be in the parliament. It's quite important to win the elections.
Would you describe the socialists and the PP sort of like the Republicans and Democrats in the United States? They're the two main parties.
Yeah.
How have they responded to the rise of Podemos?
Using the same language is something quite ironic that the center-left and the center-right party use the same words in order to attack us. And I'm sure that the voters of the Socialist Party don't like that. And many of our voters came from the Socialist Party. But unfortunately, in my country, they show that they support the same economic policy, and that was a disaster in my country. They both develop austerity policies that bring our country to a terrible situation now.
What is that situation? Can you describe unemployment and other issues?
My country have three big problems: inequality, unemployment, and debt. And the Socialist Party and the Popular Party in my country understood that the best way to improve the situation was austerity. After 5 years, or even more, even 6 years, the situation is worse than before. So we think that in democracy, if something doesn't work, you can change. And we are saying we want to organize another way to improve the situation.
Did you take Podemos's name from President Obama's whole "Yes, we can" sort of mantra leading into his election?
Of course not. The expression "Yes, we can" came from the Latinos in the 70s, fighting for their rights, and it was a good example for us. Obama was quite clever using that, but it's not a creation of Obama.
My colleague Juan Gonzalez, co-host on Democracy Now!, just wrote a column in the New York Daily News about these U.S. firms that are buying housing in Spain, raising rent and evicting tenants. He particularly looked at Blackstone Group, Goldman Sachs, Apollo Management, Cerberus, which have quietly been buying up tens of thousands of residential properties in Madrid and Barcelona at low prices. Protesters have gathered outside Blackstone Group in the last weeks in the United States to protest what not only these companies are doing here, but what they're doing in your country.
In our country, and the government is doing nothing. That's the reason, because we need to win the elections. It's completely unacceptable that these people are getting houses, and many Spanish families are without a house in a very difficult situation. I think we need a government ready to protect the people against this kind of people.
Can you explain the system in Spain that people here would find unusual, that you owe mortgage payments mm-hmm. even after you've been evicted
exactly.
from your house?
Exactly.
Explain this phenomenon, these rules in Spain that have actually led to suicides.
Yeah, exactly. When you don't have enough money in order to pay to the bank, you have to give your house, and after that you have to pay for the interest, and you have to pay for your debt. And even you don't have a house, and you have to give a very big part of your salary, if you have a salary, because you have a work, to the bank. This is completely absurd. There are many families in Spain in a desperate situation because they don't have a house, and they have to pay to the banks. And the banks have some responsibility with the crisis, not the family. So it's a completely unacceptable situation.
What should happen?
Because the government organized a legislation for the banks, a legislation very good for the banks and very bad for the families.
If you were prime minister, what would be the three major first steps you would take?
The first thing is to finish with the evictions of the families, and this is quite easy using the European law. We could stop that in the first week. I think it's very important to organize a restructuration of the debt. It's impossible to assume for a government the level of the debt now, and a fiscal reform. In my country are just the middle and small companies that pay taxes and the workers and the rich people. The rich companies and the top companies have a very little fiscal pressure, so it should be very important to make a fiscal reform.
Pablo Iglesias, you would not only be dealing with domestic policy, but foreign policy. I mean, when Prime Minister Aznar was in office, he supported President Bush in invading Iraq. But Prime Minister Zapatero, who came next, he pulled the troops out.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on issues in the Middle East, on what should happen with the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, and other conflict areas?
I think we need a new leadership that defend the peace. And I think that use military in order to confront terrorism sometimes was not useful. And I think that the policy of the United States regarding Middle East sometimes bring more problems than solutions. I think that in Europe we need a European system of defense. I don't like the military sovereignty of Europe depending on the NATO. And I think that we have to protect the peace.
The situation of Ukraine now?
I think that Europeans need a good relationship with Russia. I don't like the political system in Russia. I'm not a supporter of Vladimir Putin, but I think Europeans, we don't need a pre-bellic situation with Russia. I think some European powers were supporting a coup d'etat in Ukraine, and that's not a good news. And now Europeans are in danger.
What about the Western Sahara? It's not as well known in the United States, but it's certainly a major issue in Spain.
I think we have a responsibility with Sahara, and we should support autodetermination of Western Sahara, and I think they have the right to have their own country.
Israel-Palestine?
It's a complete disaster. Israel is violating the international law all the time, and I think that the international community should have some pressure to Israel in order to respect the international law and go back to the borders of the before the war.
Podemos has been compared to Syriza. You've described some of the ways you're similar. How are you different?
We are different because we just have 1 year of history, and Syriza is a very well-organized political party, and we have a different history and a different political context. I think the economic situation in Greece is different respect to Spain, and the economic situation too. But we think they are the possibility of change in Greece, and we admire them so much, and we are friends, and we will collaborate with them.
And do you have any words of advice for President Obama? Now, in his second term, he can't run again. Whether he will be a lame duck president or a legacy president remains to be seen.
I don't know. I don't know what could I say to President Obama. There is something that I like. We both love The Wire, the HBO series, and I like Omar too. And I read that Obama like this character Omar, and I don't know.
Why do you like The Wire?
I think it's probably the best TV series in order to explain how the power works, in politics, in media, in the organization of the work. I think it's a masterpiece. I used to teach political geography in my faculty, and all the time I was saying to my students, you have to see this TV series because it's great in order to understand how the power works.
Do you have anything like that in Spain?
Not in that level. I think that The Wire is the best series.
Pablo Iglesias, leader of the Podemos party in Spain, which is leading in at least one poll for the national elections in Spain. He is speaking today in New York at the CUNY Grad Center, 365 Fifth Avenue, at 1 p.m. We'll also be posting an interview with Iglesias in Spanish on our website later this week at democracynow.org. A very special happy birthday to Neil Shabata. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berker, Nate Felser, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us.